In book one, we saw a culmination of the yoga of knowledge, at least what is traditionally regarded as the yoga of knowledge. In the highest peaks of the spirit, the three paths meet. In book two, when Ashwapati has the vision of the world mother and surrenders himself completely at her feet, that is a culmination of the yoga of love. And in book three, we see that he reaches to the highest point where these two yogas fuse into the yoga of divine works. The Godhead of the vision, wonderful, has asked Ashwapati not to merge his heart in the void, immobile, uncaring bliss, but to be on earth and act as a Jivan Mukta, free from the bonds of error, free from the bonds of sin and evil, but continue to do divine works, continue to prepare humanity, and wait for the time when man is ready and the high prefigured divine event, the great transformation, will take place. It says not to hasten on the road because man is not yet ready to bear the infinite's weight. It reveals to Ashwapati the nature of man. He is a bundle of contraries. If suddenly he is revealed the truth, he gets even more confused than what he is. Meeting himself, he thinks it other than he. Freedom he needs, but freedom he seeks, but needs to live in bonds. He has need of grief to feel a little bliss, and need of death to find a greater life. So this is the situation. He also reveals to him that the mass of humanity is still buried in the animal mire. It has to be first taken up and humanized before it can be divinized. We want to skip this step. It doesn't work out. Before being superhuman, one has to be at least what can be called as a reasonable human being. So this is the condition of man, full of animality. And yet the Godhead assures him that yet there is in him a spark. And this spark is crossing through aeons and centuries. It does not give up. The light breaks even if for a short while. His heart opens to deep intimations of truth and beauty and bliss. And finally it says, almost one is reminded of the great word of the Gita. Gita comes to a cryptic close with this statement that Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshishyami masucha. Continue works in the world. Don't have to do anything. Don't be afraid of the battle of life. Fight. If fight you must, inwardly and outwardly, but remember me and fight. I will be with you and you will be in me. I never abandon you. My devotee never perishes. And do not be afraid of evil, error, sin. I will liberate you from all this. This is how the Gita comes to a close. Here we find a very similar ring in a very beautiful way. These last eight lines which we read yesterday remind me of these two verses of the Gita. Man mana bhav mad bhakta madhyaji ma namaskuru. And then it says, I promise you that I'll never leave you and abandon all dharmas and take refuge in me alone. In a different way, Sri Aurobindo is Sri Krishna coming again, speaking to modern humanity in its own way. So these two slokas of the Gita, somehow right from beginning, these were the lines which I had first read when, it's a very personal vein, but my first exposure to Sri Aurobindo, these were the lines I found on somebody's table. So they are very, very deeply personal, and they are like the last word of the Gita. My light shall be in thee, my strength thy force. It's a great promise. Let not the impatient tighten drive thy heart. Do not hurry up. Do not rush into nirvana, moksha, this path, that path. Trust me. Love me, become my minded, my lover, my devotee, my servant, my slave, and do thy works in the world, afraid of nothing. Ask not the imperfect fruit, the partial prize. Just as Arjuna is asking for the imperfect fruit. I want to be a sannyasi and go into the hills. Only one boon to greaten thy spirit demand. Only one joy to raise thy kind desire. Fight so that light, truth, immortality can be won for earth. Raise thy kind. This is what it means. Extending personal realization into the collectivity. Extending the personal yoga into the collectivity. Only one kind, only one joy to raise thy kind desire. And then the great assurance. Aham toa sarva papebhyo mokshishyami maasucha. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers. Moveless there stands a high unchanging will. To its omnipotence leave thy work's result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. Arjuna, when he heard these words, fell down and said, okay, I fight the great battle. Sri Aurobindo asked further. So this is now the high close of the Gita. The highest truth which synthesized the Vedanta and the Upanishads. It's the Gita. It's the fruit of that. The highest possibility. August and sweet sank hushed that mighty voice. Nothing now moved in the vast brooding space. A stillness came upon the listening world. A mute immensity of the eternal's peace. This peace that comes from the great assurance. Just to remember this divine assurance is to be full of hope, full of peace. The heart is relieved of all stress, unease, because one knows the divine has given this assurance above blind fate and the antagonist power. Similar thing we find in book 1, canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. It says, whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can do but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown, an anniversary of the birth sublime. So it is great assurance. Even when man is misguiding himself, still there is a guidance. But to Ashupati, there is a conscious assurance, direct assurance. It's no more a veiled guidance, but direct guidance. I will never abandon you. So I am with you. Surrender to me and be at peace. But Ashupati is meant to embody the anguish of the earth. How many battles, how many Mahabharatas, Ramayanas, how long? But Ashupati's heart replied to her, a cry amid the silence of the vast. Similar thing we'll see toward the end when boons are given to Savitri and she is told, that merge yourself. I open wide the ineffable's gate. You can merge yourself in this vastness. Then all the women, you know, the anguish of the earth. She's a, you know, beautifully Sri Aurobindo repeatedly speaks of her as a woman. She replies that, no, I don't want that. I want peace for earth. Thy peace, O Lord, a boon within to keep. So Ashupati replies, how shall I rest content with mortal days and the dull measure of terrestrial things? I who have seen behind the cosmic mask the glory and the beauty of thy face. As long as one doesn't come to Pondicherry, one is quite at ease, so-called, with the world. Because one doesn't have a greater vision. One is happy going to temple, doing little bit prayer, reading some philosophical books and pursuing one's life. But the moment one has seen this face, this glory, this sun, after that interest is lost in everything else. It is amazing. And many of us experience. I don't know. I went back and I could not read any of my textbooks. I said, what this psychiatry I am reading? This is so nonsense. I mean, after seeing this vision, what is this childish ignorance? but one has to clear the exams, unfortunately. Even the high books, except of course things like Ramayana, Mahabharata, a new sense is revealed in them. But many of these books of yoga, philosophy, popular series, they appear so childish because one has had the glimpse of the sun. So Ashwapati is saying, you are sending me back from these doors after having glimpsed you. You expect me to go back and be happy and content, lead a normal life just as I was leading before. I was not yet bitten by the divine grace. Literally it is like that. How can I rest content? I have to bring something, carry it there with me. And then he reveals the anguish of the earth. Hard is the doom to which thou binds thy sons. How long shall our spirits battle with the night and bear defeat and the brute yoke of death? We who are vessels of a deathless force. Even when victory comes, at what price? Look at the Mahabharata. Look at Ramayana at the end of it. All the Pandavas, they are themselves shattered seeing this bloodshed. Victory has come, but at what price? Heavy price. So if we go back again and again, we have to fight the same battle again and again. And even when the victory comes, it's so transient. Where is Bhima's Gada and the Gandiva of Arjuna? We are back, collapsing back to something so, so banal. So Ashwapati says, hard is the doom to which thou binds thy sons. This is a very interesting Urdu poetry, which is sung by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, where he refers to the divine by saying, Tum ek gorakh dhanda ho. Gorakh dhanda is like, you know, absolutely confusing. Gorakh dhanda is something you can't understand. It's so complex. He says, Tum ek gorakh dhanda ho. And then he says, you say that there is nobody and nothing else other than you. Then what is this heaven and what is this hell? And then he says, that's strange. Those who love you, you put them on the suli, on the cross, you suddenly make them beheaded. And those who don't deny you, they suddenly seem to win. We don't understand you. It's a very beautiful, actually, poem. At the end, it answers. It's a very Vedantic poem written by a mystic. But in the context of Islam, which believes in duality, too much of heaven and hell, it says, actually, it smashes it. And but in between, it raises this question. So Ashwapati says this. We are supposed to be vessels of deathless force, but death finds us in the midst of anything and everything. How long? We who are vessels of a deathless force and builders of the godhead of the race, what a task given to us. And what do we build? Nations full of cruelty. Empires which finish whatever little beautiful things are there in mankind. This is what we build. Or if it is thy work I do below, amid the error and waste of human life, in the vague light of man's half-conscious mind, why breaks not in some distant gleam of thee? Centuries, aeons, millenniums, labor and struggle and bearing the yoke of defeat and death. At least, have we not paid enough blood at thy feet, Mother Kali? Something of yours must be revealed. Mother, you know, beautifully a similar sentiment, divine sentiment, is echoed in one of her prayers during the first great war. She says, men are carried by a whirlwind in a storm of destruction. There is so much bloodshed. They are fighting, arms against arms, flung upon each other. Energy is locked in a somber conflict. Then she says, Lord, grant this, all this sacrifice may not be a waste. Always men have shed blood, and it has been a waste, only to seat greater tyrants at his back. You remove one tyrant, another tyrant comes because the human nature doesn't change. He says, how long we are going to do it? Ever the centuries and millenniums pass. Where in the greyness is thy coming ray? Where is the thunder of thy victory's wings? Only we hear the feet of passing gods. Gods came and gone away. What did he do? Well, nothing really, nothing in particular. For one day there is excitement. Somebody has come like a god. Oh, great excitement. Tomorrow somebody is gone. How long this will happen? We only hear promises. And then he, after this anguish, a plan in the occult eternal mind mapped out in backward and prophetic sight. The eons ever repeat their changeless round. These cycles all rebuild and ever aspire. Six times there have been the four cycles, Chaturyug, and collapse again. In fact, all the avatars and this thing we read is only for this cycle. We have no clue who were those in the previous cycles. Come and gone. Where are they? Who were they? What Ramayana, Mahabharatas and Ilion were staged in those six cycles which collapsed into nothingness. No trace is left. This is how long? All we have done is ever still to do. All breaks and all renews and is the same. This is one of the greatest tragedies of life. And Mother speaks of it that we need to be able to prolong life at will. Because when one dies and comes again, it is true that the inner being carries the thread. But there are so many things in this outer world of ignorance. The physicality, the animality which one inherits. Again the struggle. Simply because one has come through the process of birth, which means a heavy load of inconscient. Again, we eat inconscient, we swallow it in the atmosphere. By the time we reach that point where the past seal breaks and we resume the journey of yoga, we have already carried enough load to our already heavy load. And so, again the struggle, again the collapse, again the coming. So how long? Huge revolutions of life's fruitless chair. The newborn ages perish like the old, as if the sad enigma kept its right, till all is done for which this scene was made. New age. Every great epoch had its own new age. When people felt, finally the new age has come, the age of enlightenment, the age of post-Christ, the age after Krishna's advent. There is a feeling, something new, something better, something higher has come. But again, it begins to collapse over a period of time. Sri Aurobindo says, among the various works of Sri Krishna, one of them was to establish the nationhood. He established the nationhood. And that great and mighty nation which he established was guarded by great kings, lineage of kings, Ajat, Shatru, etc., right down the ages. But subsequently, after a while, that is eclipsed. There is the Alexander's invasion, then Islamic invasion, British invasion, and today one wonders, did it actually happen? Were there such mighty kings, such mighty poets, writers in the assembly of this very country? One wonders, is it really true? They say that at one time the Ganges was full of milk. Dudh ka nadi behta tha. Now all the milk has been swallowed by the politicians and only pollution is left in the once mighty Ganges. So what has happened? Where has all this gone? So Ashupati says that too little the strength that now with us is born, too faint the light that steals through nature's slits, too scant the joy with which she buys our pain. We think too much about ourselves. But Ashupati knows that man cannot do all this with his own effort. There is very little in him of solid substance. He is so full of vanity, so full of ego, his strength is so little, which can be broken like a reed. Even great warriors, even great sages, sage Vasishth, we know, he was a great sage, Brahm Rishi. But what happened in the course of his journey when he lost his children to Vishwamitra? He goes through dejection and despondency, goes into a state of depression, so much so that he wants to eventually commit suicide. So he ties himself with tight ropes and throws himself into a flowing river. That, look, I mean, I don't want to live in this world. It happens even to the greatest. It's very human, because this is how we endure. When he throws himself, then the river, the gods, everybody is shocked. What has happened? He's a special person. He's not like anyone else. So, inspired by the gods, suddenly the stream of the rivers flows in such a way that his bonds are cut. That's how the name of the river is Vipasha. It cuts off the bonds. Of course, now people think by taking a bath they will become free of bonds. Obviously not. Vasishth is a great one. And then this story can be interpreted in a symbolic way also, but the essence remains same. That he struggled against those parts of nature which are prone to gloom and despair. He entered into those territories, plunged into those. That either it's a last battle, either I finish myself or I come back redeemed. And by the just like the Indra and Dhritarashtra legend, the bonds were cut and he was finally freed. This is the final freedom. As the mother says, salvation is physical. It is not a crucified God body, but a glorified body that will save the world. This is the, as long as salvation is not physical, we are always subject. Inwardly we may be free, very nice. But outwardly, it's very easy to say that, you know, this world is illusion and, you know, give a nice lecture on Maya and all this. Till one develops a problem. And then, you know, one has to go through all the process, even the great yogis. Very often people mistake it that, oh, if he's a great yogi, why he has to go through physical problems and they have to be worked upon? Precisely because the body still is built of ignorance. This is the problem. Consciousness may be free. It can soar in very high realms. Who can deny the greatness of Sri Ramakrishna? And yet he has to go through throat cancer. Of course, he took upon himself the burden of his disciples. Swami Vivekananda, shining example. Glorious summits, vastness is ascended, leonine every way. But he has to go through something like diabetes and eventually leave the body, succumb to it, apparently, under the pressure of that. That is half victory. That's why he says, till all is done, your kingdom cannot be established here. There will be great yogis who will ascend into that state, but that is not what we want. We want the final, perfect victory. Here upon earth, Yeheva, as the Vedas say. Thought-racked in a brute world that knows not its own sense, thought-racked upon the wheel of birth we live, the instruments of an impulse not our own. That's what the Gita has declared. Yantra arunini maya, as a fly on the wheel moves and it thinks I am moving, but it doesn't know the wheel is moving and it is simply stuck to that. So also we are moved by our nature and we say, I thought this, I feel like this, my freedom, my independence, my will. But one is pushed by a thousand unseen hands, suggestions, thoughts, impulses, feelings, and one yields to them and is driven. So Sri Aurobindo reveals to us through Ashwapati, the instruments of an impulse not our own, move to achieve with our heart's blood for prize, half knowledge, half creations that soon tire. Just before I was coming here, somebody told me something very touching about being in this place. Said, Alok bhai, you know, the one reason, the only reason why one wants to be here is Mother and Sri Aurobindo, their samadhi, their presence. And then said something very touching. Sometimes we have to pay a very heavy price for it. And added, but still it is worth it. It's so true. Sometimes one has to pay a very heavy price. But for what? Simply because of this. So, Ashwapati has seen this, says at the end of it, what comes? Half knowledge, half creations that soon tire. A foiled, immortal soul in perishing limbs. Baffled and beaten back, we labor still. Annulled, frustrated, spent, we still survive. This also has to be the spirit of this yoga. Doesn't matter. Shobindu says, even if I saw that everything collapsed, I would look beyond the smash to the new creation which is coming. Even on the pyre, we should be able to say, Om Namo Bhagavate. Doesn't matter. If not this body, another one. We will come again and again and again. That is the spirit. That spirit survives. But if somebody is looking for quick results and says, oh, what is the use? So and so yogi, he lived, but after 70, he passed away. This is absurd. One is not ready for this kind of yoga, which needs tremendous patience. It is not just about inner realization, but about victory in the external field. In anguish we labor, that from us may rise a larger seeing man with nobler heart. What a description. A golden vessel of the incarnate truth. The executor of the divine attempt. Equipped to wear the earthly body of God. Communicant and prophet and lover and king. Five lines which summarize what that new being will be. Also shows us how far we are from that being. In anguish we labor that from us may rise a larger seeing man. Not somebody who sees only 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, maybe maximum one life. Somebody who sees in a very narrow space, in very narrow bits of time, but a larger seeing man who can look deep behind, who can look into the eyes of man and see the God to come. Nobler heart, a heart which is not crammed up with selfish, egoistic, small, narrow personal interests. Nobler heart. A golden vessel of the incarnate truth. We all have Satyavan inside. But a Satyavan which is totally entangled all around with the meshes of death. So, a golden vessel of the incarnate truth. The executor of the divine attempt. The divine will which is working in this world for transformation. Somebody who can willingly, happily bear that burden and say, yes, this is a work worth doing. And nothing else. Equipped to wear the earthly body of God. There is a body of God, Sachidananda, in Sachidananda substance, the supramental substance. And that is wonderful. But here we are to transmute these limbs so that this can become the earthly body of God. Communicant and prophet. Somebody who can see far what is going to come in the future. Someone who can communicate the incommunicable. And lover, not a rishi sitting on the tops, closing his eyes and meditating. Someone who has a heart of true love and king. Who can rule with subservient. To serve, to rule. And to rule, to serve. Sri Aurobindo summarizes it in Savitri. What are the signs of a true ruler? Who is inspired by those high realm. He serves to rule and rules to serve. His approach towards it is not by killing people, not by pulling them down, not through blind ambition, but he serves, serves, serves. And when he rules so that he can serve better, serve more. So beautiful, it opens a new vista of yoga. Why supramental yoga? So that we can know the divine better. So that we can love the divine better. So that we can serve the divine better. Because only when our consciousness is thoroughly supramentalized, or rather through and through shot with the flame and fire of truth, can we really know him as he is, love him in the true way, and serve him in the divine way. Ashwapati is not complaining. He is not a being who would do that. He's a great, great, great yogi. So he says, I know that you have something already in your heart. I know that thy creation cannot fail. The Godhead has also assured him that look, how can the end be vain when God is guide? I am the guide of this world. Have trust. Ashwapati says, yes, I know. Thy creation cannot fail. It is the divine creation. For even through the mists of mortal thought, infallible are thy mysterious steps. And though necessity dons the garb of chance, hidden in the blind shifts of fate she keeps the slow, calm logic of infinity's pace and the inviolate sequence of its will. These few lines again are such an inspiration, such a reminder. When suddenly things happen in life which we never expected, our life takes a very unexpected turn. When we feel everything is collapsing, we feel, oh, is it really God who governs this world or some blind fate, something adverse? That time we must remember the divine uses always. Sri Aurobindo says that do not try to judge the mother with your limited human mind. She can use anything for this journey. All event circumstances. We may wonder, why mother is carrying us through this? Mother, please. I thought that you will now onwards, everything will be very nice, beautiful, hunky-dory. No. She knows what is needed for us at each moment. She will give us the experiences that we need to grow in a certain way, in a certain direction. She will veil what needs to be veiled for the moment. She will reveal what needs to be revealed. She will pick up the lost threads, tie them together, and then start working in other domains. Such a complex, vast task she is engaged in. That's why the best attitude in all circumstances is to have of gratitude. Gratitude, gratitude. Something seemingly pleasant happens, gratitude. Something seemingly painful happens, gratitude. Because she is carrying us. So Ashwapati has that truth. He is revealing it. Infallible are thy mysterious steps. They are mysterious. Why God does this? He makes a Sharma get beheaded in public, makes a saint Arjun Singh sit on hot tawa, his children being put on, you know, in, being, you know, they are living and they are put inside wall and made to die. They are buried alive. See, why God does this? We don't know. It's a mysterious plan. When Guru Nanak was caught once by the Muslims and he was put inside, rather I should use the word Islamic invaders. So he was put in a prison and whipped. So his one of his close disciples says, what is this God of yours doing? You keep telling your, tera, 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 and everything you have given to God, and what is he doing with you? This is what he does. So he says, look, Banda, don't question divine's ways. Don't do this. I caution you, don't do this. No, but still, why has he done this to you? I can understand to somebody like me, he does that. He says, well, I'll answer this question tomorrow morning. Right now, just sleep. I am also tired. Let us sleep. So they both go to sleep. In the morning, he gets up. Whole night, he has not slept. This question is in his mind. Why of all the people, such a holy man has to suffer? So he asks, sir, the answer. He says, well, answer is right below you. What? Look below. Look at, you know, how many ants you have killed. He says, I can't count. He says, you know, the divine consciousness is so vast, so vast. And we are like little tiny ants. The mother at one place says, when nature moves, you think it is a punishment for some evil and you think it's a reward for something good, you are becoming, giving too much importance to yourself. When nature moves, it's a vast movement. We are all like little ants. It is not busy giving reward and punishment, as if it had no better job to do. It is rolling up waves after waves so that something better can arise. One ant dies, a worm is born. A worm dies, a butterfly is born. That's how it goes on. Sri Ramakrishna gave a very interesting example that an elephant is going, then a flea came and asked him, can I make home inside your huge ear? Elephant kept moving. It didn't answer. It doesn't care. So the flea said, thank you very much, and made a home. After some time, it says to the elephant, "Thank you for giving me space. I am leaving tomorrow. Can I leave your ear?" Elephant is again moving and the flea leaves. That is the vast consciousness. We think. The speciality of us is that that greater being should come out. Till then, we are subject to this vast movement of nature. So everything is used. Necessity, chance, blind shifts of fate is used by that wisdom, by that logic of the infinite, which is different from finite's logic. Finite logic is put in so much, you get back that reward. This is very, very business-like attitude. But God may sometimes use it if that gives us faith. But the divine logic is, infinite's logic is very different. Sometimes when we put 10 rupees in the hundi and kept 90 rupees back, the divine will say, okay. He will not see the 10 rupees you have put. He sees the 90 rupees you have held back. And sure enough, you are pickpocketed of that 90 rupees. And then you say, what, Lord, I gave 10 rupees. I thought my 90 will grow into 900. You have taken away the 90 rupees from me. It's the calm logic of infinity space. When someone came to India, mother speaks about that person, that, you know, what is the attitude of a sadhak. So when he was from the boat, stepping onto the shore, the boat shook a little bit and he was carrying a golden pen that fell down and it was lost in the current. So, you know, he is stepping down on the soil of India and the first thing is that this is gone. And then he thought, oh, but this is the effect of India. Like yesterday I was telling, we don't come to India to fill our purses. We come to India to be pickpocketed. So that we stop getting attached to that, but something else. So this is the logic of infinity space. It uses the mood of the moment to carry us. And the inviolate sequence of its will. All life is fixed in an ascending scale. Great assurance. Man does never become animal. All those story that, you know, human being becomes a worm and a rat and a chipkali. If you know, all those horrible stories created by very sadistic pandits to make us afraid, make us do some good things. Nobody ever does good things because of these stories. But they thought perhaps in their wisdom that if we threaten people, that if you do this, you will become a chipkali. They will probably do some good things. Man doesn't. He does evil with impunity. Because there is in man that something else. So all life is fixed in an ascending scale. There is an ascent going on, form to form, birth to birth. And adamantine is the evolving law. We cannot leap. It has to be through a process. In the beginning is prepared the close. This strange, irrational product of the mire. This compromise between the beast and God is not the crown of thy miraculous world. He says, I know. It is the most absurd thing to believe that man is the apex of creation. This thought I used to have 15, 16, 17. Really, they say man is highest. If this is so, really God has no creativity. I mean, this strange creature, irrational product. There is nothing in us which we should really be proud of except for this aspiration. But that also reaches so little and tires. There is nothing. Even this intelligence, everything. With all our intelligence, we do not know what's going to happen the next moment. In many things, animals surpass us in their intuitive knowledge of things, which is instinctive for them. In generosity, in their sacrifice, in their love, in their loyalty. Actually, sometimes you feel animal kind, mankind is a fall from the animal. And that's why perhaps the biblical story that man was a fall. Why? Because he tasted the fruit of knowledge. And there is a truth in it. The coming of the mind twisted the animal consciousness. The straight response of the animal. When a dog is angry, it barks. When a serpent, you step on the tail, it hisses. But man, when he stepped on the tail, he will not do anything that moment. He will give a very nice smile because that moment he cannot do anything. But he is waiting for the moment when he will attack you from behind. When he is, you know, he will find ways and means to cheat and be disloyal. Even dogs will not do it. Even cats, which are so much unfortunately maligned, they are very nice creatures. But man will do it. So, if really man is the apex, then truly God has run out of creativity or he never was creative. So, he says, I know, even logically, mental world cannot be the apex of things. I know. Then he says something very powerful. I know. This I know you see is coming from where? I know. There shall inform the inconscient cells. At one with nature and at height with heaven, a spirit vast as the containing sky. This is the supramental consciousness. In that little poem of Sri Aurobindo, one day, he reveals it. The last rock. And then he says, a step and all is sky and God. Same thing in the mother's play, The Ascent to Truth. Last step and all is sky and God. What is that which links the earth and the heaven? So that consciousness, which is one with nature and one with the highest heights, one in the lowest of the atoms, that consciousness will come and inform the inconscient cells. One day that consciousness will awaken these cells and that spirit will inhabit this mortal body. And where will it come from? And swept with ecstasy from invisible founts. Delight will be its crown and head. Delight will be its heart. And then very, very powerful line. This line is a line of meditation in itself. A God come down and greater by the fall. Amazing line. This is so many revelations come just with this one line. To be born on earth, mother says, when the supermind comes down, to be born on earth will be a privilege even for the gods. There is something they will miss out. Why? Because on earth we have the complete integral experience of truth. This revealed elsewhere in Savitri. What the white gods missed, even the black deities who opposed, revolted and plunged into this darkness, they too are safe. And describing of these dark deities, Sri Aurobindo says in Savitri, what the white gods missed, there is something they missed, which these black deities have. And when they come here, both kinds, they have the integral experience. And that integral experience is the apex. Even the gods want to take a human body. When they take a human body, it's a fall. Quite naturally, they lose that power, that might. They feel caged. The sign of these beings of a greater world are, they feel they are in a prison. They cannot do like they could do as their godhead. They could give tathastu. You see the problem. Arjuna is Indra's son. Indra's ansha is in him. How much he has to struggle? But as Indra, it was very easy. But when he takes a human birth, he has to struggle. And yet, what a glory that Arjuna has. Indra would be straining his ears to hear a word of the Gita, which is given to Arjuna and in that battlefield. So this is the beauty of coming down upon earth. A god come down and greater by the fall. Because he has accepted this mortal cloak, this struggle, this fight. And therefore he has the crown of victory. And then he says, how do I know it? Beautiful. Ashwapati has experienced this. That hidden inside atom is the same truth. The supramental truth is not just above. It is hidden inside the atom. That has burst forth from within. I have experienced it. So Ashwapati says, a power arose out of my slumber's cell, abandoning the tardy limp of the hours and the inconstant blink of mortal sight. Again, see the reference to the gods. Gods don't blink because the sight keeps extending, extending, extending. The symbol. We blink. We cannot hold our sight constantly. We shift from moments to moments of space. We see bits of space. We see parcels of time, but not the gods. Their sight keeps extending and it can span the whole universe around. So he says that I saw, but I did not see from this mortal sight, there where the thinker sleeps in too much light. And in tolerant flames the lone, all-witnessing eye, hearing the word of fate from silence heart, in the endless moment of eternity, it saw from timelessness the works of time. How absurd it is to even compare Sri Aurobindo with Heidegger, with Carl Jung, with thinkers, philosophers, just because he used a human language of thought, because that's the only way to express. But is he a thinker? Sri Aurobindo is a thinker. He has gone to that realm where the thinker goes to sleep. So we should not feel bad if we feel asleep after reading Sri Aurobindo's books. Even the thinker, the original thinker, the highest mental being, when he goes there, he goes off to sleep. Why? Because he's in the lap of that vastness. No more need to think. So he brings that knowledge from there. That sight is an absolute sight, because where is he gone? Intolerant flames the lone, all-witnessing eye, hearing the word of fate from silence heart, in the endless moment of eternity, it saw from timelessness the works of time. Sri Aurobindo is truly a perfect gentleman, that he tolerated all of us, comparing him, contrasting him, and patiently answered, Sir Bergson has said this. What about your views? At one place he says, I have no views. Sir, what do you think about this? I have stopped thinking since the days of the Arya. The entire Arya was written with a silent mind. Again, sir, but Bertrand Russell says something else. What about his views? Sri Aurobindo, patiently replying letters after letters. From where he saw, from timelessness, the works of time.